I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with our friend Devin Turnbull, the founder of Ogis, which is an audio equipment company that aims to bring realistic, natural sounds directly to the listener.
Previously, Devin was the co-founder of the clothing brand Nom de Guerre, and over the years, he has worked across a variety of projects in graffiti, music, graphic design, and clothing design.
In the world of hi-fi audio, there's no one quite like Devin. He brings a pared-down simplicity to his work, which creates profound, high-impact results. We're really excited to speak to Devin today.
But before we do, we'd first like to thank our sponsor, the Japanese watchmaker Grand Seiko, a company deeply connected to nature that brings an incredible level of craft and detail to every watch it makes. From its founding in 1960, Grand Seiko has sought to create the world's most durable and beautiful watches with the highest accuracy and legibility possible. They're pretty much the ultimate when it comes to practical watchmaking.
A great example of Grand Seiko's nature of time design philosophy is one of their newest watches, the Omi Witari, which is part of the Elegance collection. And it features this striking dial, which has been textured to mimic the undulations of the frozen Lake Suwa in Japan. The overall effect when you look at the dial is this incredible interplay of light and shadow that creates a ton of visual depth. You know, at The Slowdown, we love beautifully made mechanical objects, things that can be felt whether you see the parts or not, that there's this intangible feeling of deep craft rooted in history. And this is something that Grand Seiko is all about.
And now, our conversation with Devin, which is all about his obsession with natural, pure sound and the journey he's on to share it.
Hey, Devin, welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
Thanks, guys. I'm excited to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Let's start with how you got into making speakers. Like, where did it start? Where did the impetus to get into this kind of thing begin?
It's always hard for me to find like the moment because, you know, obviously I've been listening to records and setting up sound systems for, you know, myself or for parties or whatever for as long as I can remember. I started DJing when I was like maybe 13 years old. So records have always been an important part of my life. I always listened to a lot of music at home. I certainly wouldn't have considered myself like an audiophile when I was, you know, a teenager or in my 20s, but I did go to audio engineering school and studied recording.
Oh, wow.
Something that I think was a pretty common field of academic interest for DJ electronic music producers in, you know, the late 90s when I had actually dropped out of high school and was like going for the next thing. Didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do. And, you know, music was like kind of the center of my life. And I just decided that seemed like a good thing to study to, you know, just get me more involved with music and musicians. I guess I wasn't really ready to, or I didn't have the confidence to study like composition or playing any particular instrument on a level that I thought was a feasible career path.
Right.
So yeah, I studied audio engineering in Seattle for a couple of years and then moved back to New York where my family's from, where I was born. I kind of figured I'd come to New York and find my place as like a DJ, start working in studios. At the time, there was a group that I was really, really inspired by. And I was sort of like, if I can establish some kind of relationship with these guys, that was sort of underground avant-garde, like hip hop electronic music group in the late 90s called Anti-Pop Consortium. When I was living in Seattle, they put out this, I think I was still living in Seattle. They put out this album. I can't remember, but it's like their kind of debut album.
Yeah.
That was it for me. I was like, these guys are, they're avant-garde. That was really what I was focused on in DJing, was kind of merging hip hop with like all kinds of other forms of electronic music and not electronic music, but trying to find some unique space for myself to live in creatively and musically.
Which is something you've always done with everything. Visually, you've always found sort of your own way, which is something I really admire.
Yeah, that was something that I learned as a DJ. When I was 17, I dropped out of high school, moved to Seattle, where I had some close friends and made a lot of other really important friendships. And I was really into like turntablism and like, I guess you'd say like traditional hip hop DJing. And I got to Seattle and I realized pretty quickly that like there were these kids that were just like doing turntablism on a level that like I just didn't have the rhythm or coordination or whatever it was, you know, like I wasn't going to be a professional drummer. I wasn't going to beat these kids in like a turntable battle. And I was just like, okay, so, you know, it's the sort of thing where like, if you're an athlete, you're like, okay, so I'm not going to play basketball. I'm never going to be able to beat Michael Jordan at basketball. But, you know, in creative fields, I think if you kind of identify that you're not going to beat people on like technical skills, you can kind of define your own identity by doing things differently. And that was where I sort of started really, like, I knew that I had an interest in a really diverse mixing of genres or, you know, all kinds of music, and that I could like identify myself or differentiate myself by doing things a little differently. That was a thing that I remember like really specifically realizing. And I started playing music no one else was playing, and I started getting gigs. I met Alex Calderwood around that time, the owner of the Ace Hotels, founder of Ace. And at the time was really kind of like doing virtually everything in Seattle creatively, or, you know, musically, art, street art. He had a gallery and a bunch of bars and clubs and stuff. And, you know, he was booking me to play parties. He was recognizing me for like my creative perspective, more so than just like straight skills. And I was like, okay, so that seems to work. Anyway, that was kind of a long side story, but I got to New York and I was like, all right, I need to find a way to like meet these guys, the Antipop Consortium guys. And I had been just like writing graffiti and making some like t-shirts for fun. You know, I was never encouraged to study really design or art at all, like in high school or when I was a kid. But it was like kind of a thing that I did for fun with my friends. And A-Life had just opened. They kind of saw what I was making, some stickers and making some t-shirts, and like, why don't you just put some of that stuff in here, like on consignment, you know, just bring it in and we'll see what happens. So I brought in a few t-shirts, and like a few days later, they gave me a call and they said, hey, this guy Beans was just in here. He's in a group called Antipop Consortium. And he wanted to know if he could borrow some clothes for a show this weekend. And I was just like, bing. I was like, I mean, it was just so, it was not strategic whatsoever. The whole thing took me completely by surprise. Another common thread in my creative career is like lack of strategy and just like trusting and going with the flow. Like I see opportunities. If I feel like they're worth pursuing, I pursue them. And next thing I knew, I was, you know, making clothes and had started Nom de Guerre with my partners in Nom de Guerre, and DJing and recording really became like kind of just went off the table. Like I had to focus on my career as just like a kind of a multidisciplinary creative. But I never stopped listening to records and listening to music. So, you know, my style and perspective on listening changed to like the home. And I started taking that really seriously as like a different way to connect with music and engage with music, engage with musicians that were recording and pouring themselves into making these, you know, fully realized creative works as albums. I started to kind of typical like buying into entry-level high-end gear and sort of like working my way into that. But at the same time, I was traveling to Japan a lot because Nom de Guerre's production and sampling offices were in Tokyo. I somehow sort of started realizing that this audio scene in Japan was just like, I don't know if it was going to Akihabara initially or just kind of finding these Japanese audio magazines. This would have been like in the mid 2000s. And I started getting really interested in the Japanese perspective on home audio, which is, I think, fairly consistent with a lot of the other fields of interest that I had, where I realized that the Japanese had sort of studied American design. And instead of trying to reinvent those things, whether it's jeans or sneakers or cars or audio equipment, really just figuring out how to use them in refined ways or like building on these classic designs, you know, they're not afraid to do that. They don't need to supersede every invention with something totally original. It's like they're taking this absolute top quality, mostly pro audio gear out of American theaters and finding ways of repurposing it for use in a home audio environment. As I started to hear some of these systems, it was just like the kind of upgrade path that I was on with high-end hi-fi just started to feel like super irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because the sound is just so radically different that I was hearing in these rooms, as opposed to like I had been a few years of like changing your digital analog converter, changing your phono stage, and just trying to find things that were like maybe slightly better than what you had. That's kind of the typical like upgrade game is like, I think this thing sounds better than that thing and I'm going to go to it. And sometimes you backtrack. Sometimes you say like, I went back to this thing I had previously and I decided actually it sounded better. And then when you go and hear these systems that use mostly horn loaded, high efficiency speakers and, you know, single digit watt triode, single ended amps, it's a whole different experience.
Yeah. That you introduced me to and has changed the way I think about music in many ways. And just to sort of interject before we get too far is, what do we need? And for listeners that have no idea what a triode is or horn or any of those things, what do we need to understand on the most basic level about sound? Like, what is sound? How does it work? You know, from the broadest perspective.
What is sound? Sound is vibrations that travel through the air. So what is sound is slightly different than like, how do you reproduce sound in the most pleasant way? And, you know, people ask me all the time whether they're interested in making their own speakers or they want to just get started in hi-fi. I try to avoid preaching my perspective because the audio industry is just so, that's a big part of what got me started in making my own stuff, was it's just so hard to talk to professionals in the hi-fi industry and get like a unbiased or just like reasonable reaction from people, because people, you know, inevitably tend to, well, they've kind of prescribed to a certain way of thinking, as have I.
Yeah.
And then they have a vested interest in like selling you that thing. And so they become very like dismissive of anything else. So, I mean, obviously I'm happy to get into my perspective on audio, but.
Yeah, you have a general philosophy about sound and have operationalized that in a way.
I do.
So that's sort of what I'm most curious about.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm happy to get into that. But the only thing that I was just going to say first is that like what I always tell people when they're like, I want to learn how to design speakers, for example, I tell them, don't just study broadly how to design speakers because there are so many different approaches. You can listen to 100 speakers before you find one that you really connect with. So it would be a shame to have to build 100 different kinds of speakers before you build one you really like. The most important thing is just listening to a lot of different things and finding something that makes you want to sit down and listen to music. That's the most important thing, you know, like wanting to have a relationship with music that goes farther than, you know, background music, music that you have on while you're just like doing other stuff. For me, the most important thing is that you want to play albums and sit down and really listen to them with intention and try to understand, you know, more subtle aspects of the performance, but also the selection of the instruments, the room that it was recorded in. And it's like an emotional connection that is different with different people. But let's get into kind of my perspective. So the basic components of this type of audio system are high efficiency speakers and, like I said, low power tube amps that mostly use a type of tube called a triode, which was like the original amplification device that was invented at Bell Labs in the I'm not a tube historian, but like early triode tubes are from like the 1920s. But a triode has only three elements in a glass enveloped vacuum. I try to not to just like get too granular and just like put people to sleep. But you know, in a lot of places they call them valves, right? So it's basically, it's a control valve for the flow of electrons through this vacuum of space, right? You can think of it kind of like if you had a pipe with a lot of water flowing through it. You can control the flow of a lot of water with a small amount of effort by turning like a valve, right? You're basically doing the same thing with a triode tube with no means of like increasing the efficiency. It's just a very straightforward way of having a gain of voltage through one stage of amplification. But that is to say, basically, it's a minimalist approach to reproducing sound. In a typical audio system, if you're listening to vinyl, right, you have a tiny motor, which is the cartridge, that's vibrating in the groove of a record. And inside the cartridge, the cantilever is moving either a small coil of wire or a small magnet next to a coil of wire. There's a coil and there's a magnet. And either the magnet or the coil is moving, and it's a tiny electrical generator. If you know how electric generation works, particularly if you know how like a windmill works, you've essentially got like a turbine, and you've got a 60 or 50 cycle rotating essentially magnet and coil of wire that's creating an electrical signal. That's exactly what's happening inside of a phono cartridge. But given the tiny amount of electrical force that's happening inside of the cartridge, the output signal is tiny.
Mm.
It's nowhere near enough power to move the cone of a speaker. The speaker is the exact same type of device in inverse. You've got a coil of wire around a magnet, and the signal, the flow of electrons through the coil are causing an electromagnetic reaction. It's causing the cone of the speaker to move. But obviously, the more force you want there, you need more power going to the speaker. So in my opinion, you want to do as little to the signal as possible to take a tiny signal coming out of the cartridge and amplify it until it's powerful enough to move the cone of a speaker. The simplest, cleanest way of doing that is with these very simple circuits and vacuum tubes.
Mm. Tell us about what results from that. Like what about the tone? What makes it the experience of listening to your equipment different than most of what's out there?
I would say purity and simplicity. My goal, and I think everyone's goal, is to kind of like convey the emotion of the artist that was originally, you know, creating these sound waves that are going to like dance into your eardrums and make your brain feel good. There are various ways of kind of trying to get that direct experience as much as possible.
What's your way of working, I guess, like when you're making and creating these experiences, do you take time off and then return to it?
I work mostly here in my sort of like home listening room, and I listen to music, you know, every day in here. I always try to have a mixture of equipment, which is like products that I've either built myself for myself, hopefully can on some level offer to other people,
mm-hmm.
and then other outside manufactured or built products by, whether it's like, you know, an artisan that hand makes amps or commercialized mass produced product, and then, you know, try to get a sense of what effect that particular device has on the sound of my system, and mm-hmm. whether I think that's getting me closer to where I want to be or not. And if I feel it's made a positive overall difference in the way my system sounds, and I try to understand, you know, how it works and why it's going to do that.
I wanted to get back a little bit to sort of how you got into it, how you learned about it, and specifically the pilgrimages to Japan and France. And you've spoken in the past a bit about a particular person that you met who kind of mentored you and was a historian and archivist of audio equipment. Tell us a bit about that.
I guess around this time that I started taking home audio seriously as like just part of a practice for myself, like sitting and listening to music and wanting to have that experience, I'd had these kind of like bad experiences going into hi-fi shops in the US and then had like very positive experiences just like going to Akihabara, walking around, finding showrooms, whether it's like vintage gear or DIY gear. DIY is very, in America, there's this sort of if you walk into an American hi-fi shop and you mention like the letters D, I, and Y next to each other, they'll just basically try and turn you around and like get rid of you as quickly as possible. DIY has like a stigma in the American high-end audio world that it's like not valid. Whereas in Japan, I think you can't really consider yourself an audiophile, or they use the term audiomaniac, if you don't have at least some experience with building things yourself. So, you know, I'd had these kind of bad experiences like in some of the hi-fi shops in the US, and I just sort of started thinking, can I build most of what I want myself? And just kind of like delved into the audio underground, like as a spectator or as just purely a curious consumer, I guess. I knew how to read circuit schematics from, you know, my time in audio school. Like I took classes on how to troubleshoot gear and repair gear and stuff like that. I knew that I could build an amp if I could source all the parts and find a circuit that I wanted to build. I also knew that I could build a speaker if I learned cabinetry, if I learned woodworking. So I joined a sort of co-op wood shop in Bushwick back in the early 2000s or mid 2000s. It was called Third Ward. They're not around anymore, but it was like a multidisciplinary like studio that you could rent sort of like a locker and share tools in. And I just started learning, you know, millwork, cabinetry, woodworking. And at the time I was like, I just really want to have a whole system that I have a complete understanding of like the inside and outside of every piece of gear in the chain, from the pickup to the speaker. I want to know what's going on inside every device. I also had heard a number of systems in Japan that I just thought were like major jumping off point for me inspiration wise, that were built around Western Electric or Altec Lansing, JBL. It's kind of one family of designs and products that were developed from the 1920s and produced, I mean, I guess in a sense, sort of up to now, mm-hmm. but really like Altec Professional was like this direct line of heritage from very important speaker components that kind of went into patenting the basic building blocks of a sound system. And they built these things on a level that was just totally uncompromising, because they were just trying to say, no one's ever done this before. How good can we make this sound? Like, how realistic can this reproduction get? And I was just really, really attracted to the sound of this equipment. It's so dynamic, lifelike, and immersive. You know, it's like so present that you just feel like this, the whole room is like live with sound, as opposed to like really accurate sound coming out of a speaker.
I mean, people talk about spatial audio today. You know, it's this thing in the last year that's really come out, and it's kind of hilarious because it's sort of a replication of what you're actually doing with the speakers. You know, the first time I sat and listened to your speakers, you are in the room, mm-hmm. you know, specifically with a live recording that we listened to. You were there. The presence that you had, it was just another thing. It's sort of hard to articulate. It's like standing in front of a painting and the way it activates your eyes, a really great painting. It's similar, that my ears really hadn't been activated in that way. It's different.
Yeah, I think viewing art is a really interesting way to think about listening to music as well. At some point, I kind of came up with this idea that, like, you know, listening to a fully realized album is like going to see a masterpiece. You know, live music is fun, but live music is a bit like going and watching a painter paint, which is interesting, but it's not like what we do. You know, that's not the realization of the work. Listening to music should be a similar experience to going to a museum or going to a gallery to view art. We don't just look at art in any random room, really great art. You want to see it in a room where it's exhibited in a way that like you are just experiencing the art. You know, it's usually a white box, right? It's like kind of the pure experience of just seeing that work. I definitely always think about that when it comes to listening to like a whole album. Like, I want to sit and listen to this record and kind of try to understand what the whole process of recording it and composing it was like, and what the artist is trying to express while they're playing the music.
And in Japan, that's something you can go do. I mean, there are places where you can just go to listen to a record.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, to be honest, the home audio world in Japan is even beyond what you find in those. I mean, the bars and cafes are very cool, and they're trying to give you a really pure experience of hi-fi. And that is an important part of the Japanese audio scene. But one of the main sources of inspiration that I have is this running journal of audio technology from Japan called MJ, Radio and Experiment. I can only give you what I know, because I'm not a fluent Japanese speaker. I can't really read the magazine, but I have hundreds of issues that I've imported and have in my collection. And I translate them myself through like Google Translate, and I can read the katakana and hiragana, and like kind of, I can easily follow a circuit diagram, a schematic. But when it comes to like following the articles and like the journal as it progresses, but it comes out every month. So there's 12 issues a year. Each one is about 120 pages or something like that. And this is, I don't know when they started publishing this thing, but it may have been pre-war or just post-war, because a lot of this generation of audiophiles that are like the people talk about Japanese audiophilia and, you know, the Japanese audio perspective, but this was like a massive hobby for young Japanese people going back to the time of building like radio sets. Mm. And so a lot of the guys that have these rooms that are a ground up built, spec built listening room with hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment in them, they're like World War II generation Japanese guys that were into usually like ham radio and home radio sets. They talk about, I was 12 years old. It was like, you know, 1953, and my dad bought like a radio set that I built from a kit or something like that. That's where they start. And then it's just this evolution of like, you know, 50, 60 years of finding refined ways of reproducing music. Most of them, and in this generation, they go back to pre-record player days, where they started, most of them, listening to like NHK radio and trying to reproduce like the classical music program on the radio as high fidelity as possible. And yeah, so this magazine is an incredible resource. You know, I learned so much from it. There are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of tube audio circuits published. The magazine's not like a review magazine like Stereophile or something like that. It's like an in-depth technical analysis of every major piece of gear that comes out that they consider like relevant to their perspective on audio. And they talk about the big speaker in a small room. You know, like a lot of people in conventional high-end audio in America, they'll look at a system like mine and they'll be like, this guy doesn't know anything about audio. Speaker's way too big for the room. But there's something about the way a massive speaker couples with a room that most people would consider is too small for it. And when you use it with extremely delicate, low power amplification devices, and you know, you have a lot of attention paid to like every component in the signal chain, if you can get it to sound really pleasant, that's where you get that magical presence that you're referring to, where it's like, wow, like I feel this music in a way that I just don't feel music when it's coming out of a lot of the other speakers that I've heard or the other audio systems I've heard.
Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily about how loud it is. It's about the pressure coming out of the speaker.
Exactly. And by using like large diaphragms, you want the speaker to work as little as possible. Most of these speakers that I build, when I play them at any volume that I would ever want to listen to music at home, you cannot see movement in the drivers. Like they're moving air so effortlessly that like there's not like that intense piston action that you see on a small, less efficient speaker with a lot of power going into it. And I think you get a lot more like textural detail that way and a lot less distortion because the speaker's having to work less hard.
I wanted to ask more broadly from your time in Japan and all your experience there, what sort of influence has that culture had on your thinking and your work?
Yeah, I've spent a good amount of time in Japan when we were doing Nom de Guerre, the clothing brand I did. Our kind of development and production studio was over there. So I was spending a couple months a year, I think for the better part of a decade. It's really hard to like articulate to someone who's never been to Japan. And it's also hard to articulate to someone who's only spent a little bit of time in Japan as well. I used to go on trips, my now wife, when we were like kind of early on in our relationship, she'd never been there. She's half Chinese, half Puerto Rican. She's spent time in Europe, but she'd never been to Japan. And I did a thing that, you know, I think everyone does when they come back from Japan. You just can't shut up about the stuff that they like experienced while they were there, or like how different things are. And they just get so sick of hearing about it. And they're like, look, you're such a Japanophile. Everywhere has unique things. And it's obviously true. Yeah, for sure. But if there's something so overwhelming in Tokyo, you tend to like, people are like, oh, this one other guy from New York is here. You guys should hang out while you're here. And it may be someone that you vaguely know. It may be someone who you've never met, but you have some, you know, degrees of separation from, and you wind up like, you always wind up hanging out with other like New Yorkers that are in Tokyo while you're there. I love a first timer because they're just like bugging out. It's pretty shocking, I think, the first time you go there, just the way everything's approached, from just walking down the street and seeing people do like road work in a way that's just like so as quiet as possible, as organized and clean as possible. And you watch people like, you know, cutting a section out of a road and like repairing something underground and resurfacing the road. And there's just no construction debris.
No trash.
No trash. Yeah. People are just like thinking differently here.
There's also this connection to with simplicity in your work that's also very Japanese in a way. And could you talk about that, like this approach to fewer, better parts and also often older, less complicated parts?
For sure. There's a juxtaposition between like minimalism and like maximalism in this work that I'm very drawn to. If I draw you a circuit diagram of one of my amps, it looks incredibly simple, right? It's just like a handful of resistors, capacitors, some transformers, and some tubes, and a little bit of wire. I mean, it's just the simplest circuit. It's the simplest design. And sure, people who are into, you know, digital signal processing and, you know, what the high-end audio or studio industry would call state of the art, it looks very unsophisticated, right? It's just like most basic type of amplifier. But then you look at it and it's also like massive and extremely heavy. I can, especially these days with Class D amps, you know, like switching amps and tri-path amps and all these really efficient methods of amplification, I could bring you a 1000 watt Class D amplifier that is the size of your phone and it weighs, you know, a few pounds. And then I have an amplifier that has, you know, 2 watts of output power and it weighs like 70 pounds and is, you know, the size of a suitcase. And I mean, I have to admit that there's something that's fundamentally like attractive to me about that, that there is like, at one time you're taking a minimalist approach to reproducing the sound, but I think visually it's anything but minimalistic, right? It's like the system is huge. But that minimalist approach allows you to just focus on component quality. And, you know, this stuff is also uses a minimal amount of parts, but it's not cheap. If you build this stuff with cheap parts, it's going to also sound cheap. There's no way of masking that. So, you know, the thing is like a lot of times with modern digital equipment, there are like various methods of removing distortion and eliminating noise through a complex circuitry or digital processing, one thing or another. You can't do that with this kind of equipment. It's susceptible to every form of interference and noise and distortion. If any one component is not working perfectly, you hear it immediately through the speakers. I'm sure that there are many parallels we could draw to other things. I like to also talk about cameras, and I'm not a photographer, but cameras in relation to audio equipment. Andrew, like, is there anything that you would want to say about cameras in terms of like simple analog devices versus complicated digital?
Essentially, it's the same thing. Light and sound travel in very similar ways. Mm-hmm. And the most exquisite photograph that you could possibly make would be a light sense, a very large light sensitive material, an oversized, ridiculously large light sensitive material with an exquisite piece of glass in front of it and a mechanical shutter that allowed the amount of light in that you needed. And it's the same thing, how mm-hmm. we've come so far by ticking boxes about what something should be and the perfection of something, like, you know, a smartphone camera or something. It takes a nice looking sunset picture or something, but do you feel it? Not at all. There's no volumetric feeling. The sense of Z space, the sense of volume that occurs when you take a completely purist approach can never be replicated.
Mm-hmm. It's quite obvious why we would figure out ways of making the technology smaller, more accessible, more lightweight. But I think it's also important to have both experiences, you know, and that we don't forget about these incredible technologies that are pure and basic mm-hmm. because we have a smartphone and a wireless speaker.
And I mean, what's happening to people's appreciation and connection with the, as you referred earlier, like the completed artwork itself, the music, when you're listening to music on digital signals that are compressed and just altered in some way, you experience the music differently, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. When I first started getting really into this as, I don't know, I refer to it as like a practice. You know, people ask me what I do. I still have no idea like what to say. You know, I don't consider myself an engineer. I certainly don't consider myself like a marketer or like an audio brand owner. I'm just kind of like doing this practice. And as people are attracted to it, my goal is to help facilitate their entry into that same practice.
Mm. If someone would say, what does Devin do? I'd say he's a steward of natural sound. I mean, everything you've been doing has been about sort of conservatorship, preservation, bringing things to people that may not know about them and making sure that these things don't go away.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important part of this kind of practice. Hmm. But as I started getting into this practice of just intentionally listening to music at its core, right? As you start to focus on the equipment as much as you focus on the music, I initially thought like, well, you know, I don't want to change the music I listen to. I just want to have a better experience listening to the music that I love. But it inevitably does happen that as you focus on equipment and reproducing music as beautifully as possible, you also start to appreciate music that has much more subtle levels of like texture and detail and emotion in it. Mm. And it changes the music you listen to in a positive way, I think. And I can clearly remember where I sort of thought like, that's where these audiophile guys like lose the point. They stop listening to the music that they liked. They start listening to like this weird, you know, this weird like audiophile music and listening to like audiophile recordings before great music. And I mean, I try to maintain that perspective. I think that when you come and listen to music with me, you're never going to hear the same music that you hear in like a high-end stereo store that's on like the demo disc of like the audiophile playlist. I'm listening for things that I think I couldn't appreciate before I had this kind of system. And I'm very happy that I can have that experience with sound that lets me, you know, have a really amazing time sitting and listening to music, which is not always just about like an overt message, but more just about like really subtle levels of artistic expression.
Yeah, totally. And I think one of the things that you're now making possible, you mentioned DIY earlier, and you created this speaker making kit, which you've kind of described as a civilian relief effort. You've also talked about this sort of homebody movement that's come about during COVID. So I wanted to ask, how are you thinking about this notion of home audio and home listening, the act of deep listening, basically, right now? Like during this time, what does it mean to be able to have space and time at home, away from everything, to just listen?
As things really started to shut down, It was actually Virgil Abloh. He hit me up and he was just like, if you haven't realized it yet, like this is your moment right here. And it was lucky that I had been developing this small speaker that I thought was going to be sort of marketable to a wider audience, just because it's more accessible financially and it just fits in a smaller space, less of a commitment, let's just say. And I was sitting on my stoop, just kind of feeling really overwhelmed by everything as the world shut down. And just like, man, what can I do? Because we couldn't continue. At the time, we were producing a lot of like very large scale systems for mostly commercial spaces, bars, restaurants, nightclubs, and stuff like that. But to be clear, like my passion is two-channel stereo, home audio. And I was just like, well, we can't even do like full production runs of speakers right now. We'd like laid off everybody in the cabinet shop. And it was just kind of down to like myself, the master cabinet maker I work with, who runs the wood shop, and, you know, a bunch of other people that I work with were around, but nobody wanted to like work in the same space together. So I came up with this idea of, all right, like what can we produce with just Eric, who's my cabinet maker in the shop by himself? Like what could he do that would be scalable and that I could offer people as a DIY kind of thing? We can't paint anything. I know that's not going to be on the table just because of the way we're set up. And even like trying to glue up and sand and just make fully produced cabinets, not going to happen. You know, maybe we can just, because we have CNC, maybe we can just process boards in the CNC and just flat pack a kit that you can assemble at home yourself. And I thought, you know, I don't know, maybe I can find like 5 or 10 people that'd be into building themselves a speaker. And it'd be really cool if I could find enough people to fill, like people are starting to do those multi-person Zoom meetups, you know, with like a bunch of people. And I was like, maybe I could fill up a little workshop on a Zoom call or something like that. So I just kind of, as I was sitting there on the stoop, just did a post like, you know, what about DIY audio? Like who would be down to build one of these speakers? And I had no, I mean, I was really not expecting, it was like a pretty insane response. Hundreds of comments from people all saying enthusiastically that they wanted to participate. So over the next couple of weeks, we basically designed and prototyped this do-it-yourself kit speaker. And Virgil volunteered to help with the sales aspect of it, because there's no way, I still don't have like a website, you know? I mean, this whole thing has really just evolved from my building myself equipment and listening to music at home, you know? And I don't have like a web, you can't go to my website and say like, okay, what does this guy make? And you know, how much does it cost? And what does it do? You kind of have to like, just follow along and get a sense of what I'm doing. And if you're drawn to it, I'm happy to help you learn about it. We got a pretty overwhelming amount of orders from that initial drop. We did two drops. One that was just kind of like me to that list of people who had been like, please let me know if you're going to do this. And then we did a second one that we promoted a little bit more. We made some t-shirts and stuff to have fun with it. And it wound up being the kind of thing that for 2 or 3 months, we couldn't do anything else in the shop except for just like flat pack these kits and ship them out, which is great because we had nothing else to do. But of course, you know, now we have a lot of things to do. I mean, it's just been the most rewarding experience I can imagine of people that A, have fun building speakers, and B, probably once a week, I just get a random like text message, email, DM from someone just saying like, this has changed my life. Like my daily routine is just totally different than it was before. You know, I'm really listening to music in a ritualistic way. I'm connecting with music and sound in a way that I never had before. And I mean, like that's a 100% success right there, you know?
It must have altered your state through the pandemic in such profound ways to know that you were connecting with people through something you really loved and showing them how to be a part of it. And the feedback was phenomenal. People were customizing them, doing all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it again, wasn't something that like I planned or even realized was happening. I mean, I was just overjoyed and overwhelmed by like the amount of people that wanted to, I say, like participate, people that wanted to buy the kits. And I don't think I realized for a while, like the impact it had overall, you know, even people who didn't participate in the program, you know, even people who didn't buy the kits or build the speakers, they're like, it was just really fun to watch this resurgence of home building and that experience of sitting and listening to music. It was amazing. I'm very grateful.
So Devin, I know you don't, you know, think too much about the future and you're sort of focused on today and the present, but just before we wrap up, do you have sort of upcoming things you want to do as we emerge from this? Are you hopeful or excited about certain things as we move out of this time?
Yeah. My operation has grown over the last couple of years or over the last year. You know, I have a couple employees now. And so I approach the business and organization differently than I was before. I'm taking it more seriously in terms of developing products that are a little bit more commercializable without losing, you know, that kind of like art studio approach to building audio equipment. I'm working with a new engineer, a circuit designer that is someone who I've respected for a very long time. So yeah, trying to maintain the perspective of scalability and develop some new products that are a little bit more accessible for people who are just getting into it.
Maybe because now you saw that before you weren't sure if there was a real need for scalability because you weren't driven by commercial success. You were driven by the love of what you're doing. And maybe because of the connection with all these people through lockdown and this DIY kit, maybe that showed you, well, there's like a soulful reason to scale.
Absolutely. As you said earlier, I think like furthering the interest in serious home audio and this perspective on reproduction and just like the spirit of kind of like DIY and a deeper understanding of sound. My goal is just to continue spreading my love of that and people's understanding of it and really just try and keep it alive as a hobby. Ultimately, it's this hobby.
Yeah, but you've also referred to it as a wellness product.
Indeed.
And you've monetized the hobby.
Yeah, I've been doing this fairly successfully, professionally for better part of a decade now, as it just continues to allow me to like deepen my experience.
Yeah.
And access more and more stuff and build more and more stuff and listen to more and more stuff and just kind of share that journey with people. Mm.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and sharing the story with us, Devin. This is really, really great.
Thanks a lot, guys. It was fun for me.
Thanks to our episode sponsor, the Japanese watchmaker Grand Seiko, which raises the pure essentials of watchmaking to the level of art. You can learn more about the company at grand-seiko.com. And thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv. This episode was produced by Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Pat McCusker.